Session number 27083, Reel 43.
So Henry, you were referring to your opposite number.
Well, that was later on. He eventually became SAP Lant, and so I had a lot of dealings with him when I was a fleet commander. He was very reluctant to give up his cap, and he couldn't understand how on earth he'd ever get his cap back, and he was very impressed when he did. Well, we arrived at... just opposite the stairs up to the painted hall for lunch. And CNC was in the center of a table going across on the dais up top, and he had Prince Philip on his right, and I forget who he had on his left, probably Sakura or whatever, and so on. And as we entered the precincts getting up to the painted hall, there were the Frenchmen, and they were lying in wait for the CNC, and they were going to be rude back to him, and they were not going to go to the lunch, and they were generally being pretty bitchy, and I managed to persuade them to go away. But the lunch was going to go on, and I lied in my teeth and I said, "The CNC is not coming through this doorway, so you're wasting your time hanging around here." And they went. I don't know where they went, but that was that. And I wasn't at all convinced that they had gone away for good. And so once we'd sat down, which we did quite quickly then, and I was somewhere down in the body of the hall, and I grabbed a menu and wrote on the back to warn the CNC that the French were upset, which you must have realized because they'd walked out, to the extent that they were lying in wait and were going to sabotage him as soon as he came out after lunch. And I initialed this and summoned an old pensioner steward and said, "Now, do you know Admiral Frewin?" And he said, "No, he didn't." And I said, "Well," and I pointed out, and I described people. I said, "The chap with a rather dark complexion sitting in the middle there, do you know Prince Philip?" "No, he didn't," and so on. And I was meticulous in pointing this out. And eventually he said, "Yeah, all right. And I gave him the menu card and said, "Go and give this to CNC." And I watched him go up. And he got up behind the top table, and he handed it to a rather surprised Prince Philip. And that was that. Well, that really was the end of the symposium. And the CNC, while still at Greenwich, I don't know whether it was that same day, it might have been, I suppose. He, around tea time, I said that evening probably, he gave a sort of a drink party to those who had been involved and so forth, which was nice. And then he flew off in a helicopter because he was then going to go from Northwood. He'd stopped being CNC, or was about to stop, and was going to Portsmouth. And that was that. And he got hold of me and he told me what he thought of me. And he said he didn't think it would do much harm, and so forth. And by that stage, I had a changed appointment. And instead of going as director of the tactical school, I was to go as director of naval plans in the Ministry of Defence.
So Henry, before we move on, I just have two questions for you. The first is, were you disappointed that you were moved from the senior officer's war course at such short notice? I assume you never went back to it, you never had another chance.
No, I didn't. Yes, I was disappointed in that I was thoroughly enjoying it. It was, by way of being something of a sabbatical, there were a lot of nice people on it. The standard of lecturing and the way of life were congenial and very high, and it was only for 5 months anyway. And that does nobody any harm, just to take a deep breath and be in a position to think about other broader things, as opposed to being totally absorbed in the minutiae of the day-to-day events. So I was disappointed, which said, I couldn't have had a more interesting job than to be the personal staff officer of a very fine man like Admiral Frone. I learned a great deal from him. He wasn't everybody's cup of tea. We got on very well together, dare I say it, and I thoroughly enjoyed it. I don't know why my subsequent appointment, which we're just coming on to, was changed from director of the tactical school to director of naval plans, but if anything was a change for the better from my point of view, and I was very glad that I was to go as plans. Being a greedy officer, I wouldn't half have minded doing a year as director of the tactical school before going to director of naval plans, but that wasn't on offer.
Thank you. My, you've led right into my second question, which is that do you think that did you ever reflect upon why you were chosen by Admiral Frone? How did he alight on you to be his personal staff officer? And upon your reflection, did you think it might have been because you stood up to him over the Galatea question and other matters? And he said, oh, here's someone who can look after himself in a corner. I'll have him as my personal staff officer.
I can't really answer that question because I'm not Admiral Frone, which you'll appreciate. And so I don't really know. But I think despite his frostiness, coldness, shock, call it what you will, when I did stand up to him, I think that there was no dislike or whatever engendered in him, and I can only suppose that he thought I was a fairly reasonable chap. And of course, in absolute terms, the any sailor on the senior officer's war course, and certainly the way the Navy played it, was to an extent a bit of a drafting margin. And so it wasn't going to upset any organization. It didn't have to be a great heave round. I was just plucked out and they were one short. So it was all quite easy. And I can't remember what other sailors were on it with me. Not very many, but there must have been some. I was probably, in fact, indeed I was, the senior naval officer on that particular course. And that was the sort of chap he wanted, because he wanted someone to really act on his behalf when he was busy doing other things, which was quite often, or when he was away, which was also quite often. I think that's how it came about.
Thank you. Well, now you go to Director of Naval Plans in the MOD.
That's right.
And this is your first time to the MOD?
No, because I had been there, and it was a very useful early training in a way, although a lot had changed. I'd been based there, in fact it was the Admiralty, but it was the same thing, any different, doing the planning for the coronation. I'd been there for the Scotland, the Officer Structure Survey Committee. I'd been there for reviewing the ship and squadron, aviation squadron command exams. So I knew quite a bit about the MOD. If of all the jobs then open to a captain in the MOD, there was absolutely no doubt in my mind that Director of Naval Plans was top of the pops. And indeed, although others might contest it if they were other directors, I think it was generally, however, tacitly assumed. And when you held meetings with other directors, almost always you were in the chair, which didn't stop them telling you where to get off or anything of that sort. But it was a very key job, and I was delighted to get it. The hierarchy at the time, the First Sea Lord was Verrill Begg, a full admiral. The vice chief was Peter Hill Norton, a vice admiral, and your immediate boss, who was assistant chief policy. There were three assistant chiefs, one for policy, one for ops, and one for operational requirements. And the assistant chief policy, my immediate boss, was a delightful man called Ian Easton. This was the sort of job where, and one knew it, you were going to have to work long hours without the option. You would get away at weekends, hopefully, normally, and I did for very nearly all, but there were exceptions. But in the middle part of the week, you would just grind yourself into the ground, run yourself into the ground. If you attempted to catch a train just to go to somewhere in the middle south of England, and then you'd have to get up next morning. You had to temper your life to meet the circumstances, but on the whole, you were starting work at about 8. I got into the habit of going in, being in at my desk by 8, hopefully to have an hour on my own, uncluttered by other people coming to see you or you being sent for by elders and betters. Because on the whole, elders and betters usually started nearer to 9 than 8. And then in the evening, of course, it was anybody's guess, but you went on until you got to a certain stage and you thought that the rest could wait until the next day and so forth. You had to ensure that there wasn't too much of the rest, otherwise you very quickly built up an impossible backlog and the business of the day got stifled. But it was all very worthwhile. You were in on everything. When I first called on Admiral Hill Norton, the vice chief, I remember him saying that very few days would pass when at one stage or another we didn't meet. And he was right.
And did you view that with trepidation, given Peter Hill Norton's reputation, or not?
I viewed it with an element of uncertainty to begin with, I have to confess. But I quickly came to terms with that. And he was very good, and despite his curious, I think rather personal, quirk of effing and blinding at you when you first arrived in his office, he having just sent for you, that meant you were probably all right. And if he ever had occasion, which he never did to me, to say good morning or good afternoon, then you wanted to watch it because you were for it. But he never did that to me. And Ian Easton was very wise. He was a direction officer by specialty. A very good one, a very wise one, the easy one, but ran a taut ship and didn't say any nonsense, and you had to nail stuff and so forth. But very, very good to do business with. He was another professional. And the First Sea Lord, of course, Verrill Begg, who I'd known previously when he'd been the unified commander, the first really proper unified commander out in the Far East.
Very good man, a natural statesman, and he played it accordingly. So they were marvelous people to work for, and there was a great deal of work that they demanded of you. And that was the way it went, and you didn't complain about that.
Can you describe your function for me? What actually does the Director of Naval Plans do?
You were responsible for planning the future Navy. This meant, in the OK phraseology, was size and shape. You were responsible for forward-looking plans for this or that capability without actually getting down to specifics in terms of hardware, for whom there was another director. You were responsible for such joint planning as went on, but that was centralized with the central staff, and you were the naval rep, and so you briefed your naval, in my case, man on the central staff, what line to take, and so forth. You were almost invariably under some form, large or small, of defense review, which was a recurring obstacle. So you were never given a handout. It was always the other way. It was always a cuts exercise. And if you had to cut something, then you were really directly responsible for recommending what should be cut and why. And none of it was easy. And that sort of thing. So savings. And of course, this was going to go on, and it was going to go on indefinitely, as far as one could see, and that's exactly what has happened. So you were at pains to indulge in an artifice called wedging, and just to touch on, as an aside, touch on the financial aspect for the moment. For each year, you had an exercise called a long-term costing. And that covered the next, whatever it was, 9 years or so. And it was fair to say that for the next 2, 3 even financial years, the money allocated was actually committed. You were cutting steel, you were building ships, you were doing things, you were procuring equipment, stuff was coming off production lines and so on. And therefore to make savings in the early years of the costing period, which was a rolling program, each year, the 9 years, moved on 1 year and that sort of thing. But to save money in those of any significance in those early years was almost impossible without cancelling something and further, depending on the size of the enforced cuts, something that really rather mattered. It might so matter that it would fundamentally change a mega slice of your whole policy. And then you were in trouble, so you endeavoured to avoid that. As examples, you were keeping and constantly updating, in the light of changes, the size and shape of the future Navy, in a nutshell. And, for example, one of the things at the time that acutely occupied me was the question of the Corps of Royal Marines, which was at full strength then, and for example they certainly had 7 Royal Marine bands,
What was full strength then? I mean, compare it with
I was
today.
Afraid you'd ask that, and I'm not sure if I can remember. But we had, I think it was five commando groups or equivalent. And we had seven Royal Marine bands. And nobody understood about them. They thought a band was just a bit of music. And of course they were the stretcher bearers and so forth in under action conditions. And that took a bit of explaining. And everybody was hacking at them. And all the politicians were hacking at them. They didn't understand why there was such a thing as a corps of Royal Marines. Why have the Royal Marines? Why have they got to be this funny little slice of the Navy and yet not the Navy? They were actually an integral part of the Navy. And in those days, any big ship had its own detachment of Royal Marines, and so on. And very fine people they were. But the clever politicians, not always quite so clever, who didn't really know what they were doing, were new to the job, like many of the rest of us were, and they came in knowing nothing. They probably immediately adopted preconceived ideas and so forth, and they said, well, why do we need Royal Marines? What about, after all, we've got the SAS, and we've got the this, and we've got that, so why have Royal Marines? And so on. And I can remember having to justify the Corps of Royal Marines. Not being a Royal Marine myself, it gave me pause for thought. And so I distinctly remember I was charged to do this by Peter Hill Norton, because he thought that, very reasonably, he didn't want to let go anything until he absolutely had to, particularly if he was doing a good job, and they were. And so I thought, well, now, how do I justify the Corps of Royal Marines? And I started with, absolutely off the top of my head, I said, well, supposing you have a small position that needs to be guarded, so you have to place a sentry. That's one man. Well, he can't be a very good sentry if he has to look out over 360 degrees. So that really means you've got to place two sentries. And even that is not very efficient, so you really need three sentries. And I worked it up, three by three by three, and so it went on. Because you keep watch for, say, 4 hours, and then we have 4 hours off, so you need another three, and so on and so forth. And I screwed it up and did a bit of fiddling until I got to the magic figure of 803, which was a commando group. And then there was the question of the bands. Well, with five commandos, you needed seven bands because you had to have a certain amount of room or of rotation and so forth, and so on. And there were, that sort of thing took quite a long time to work out, and you had to be, and be seen to be, utterly convincing. And every man's hand was against you, because if you, the Navy, didn't give, say, the Royal Marines or some ships or something or other, other services would have had to have given more, and they weren't prepared to do that. And that leads me on to the awful, reprehensible, but actual infighting that went on in the MOD. I don't think it did outside in the field. I never came across it in the field. But inside the MOD, the knives were out, and it was a no-holds-barred situation. It was irresponsible. It was very inefficient. It wasted, and I mean wasted, an exorbitant amount of time, and it was absolutely rabid. And everybody was standing firm to defend his own patch, and I'm talking now of the service chiefs, and the arguments were intense and rife. And it was a difficult time.
Can you give some examples?
And it's been like it ever since.
Has it?
Sir Henry, I have two questions there, really. The first was that I'm going to ask you to give some examples, which we'll come back to, if I may. But you just picked up on, I'd like to pick up on something you said there when you said that it's been like it ever since. Because, and I ask this question because in this context, as you know, I've met Peter Hill Norton earlier this year.
Mm-hmm.
And he said that this appalling inter-service rivalry was quite outrageous. And that when he became First Sea Lord, the first thing he did when he met, when he was appointed, was to meet with his opposite numbers, principally, I think, an Air Force officer, and to agree that this would stop, and that any officer who continued in the same style as the old school would be dismissed.
Well, I can only say that, and I was there when he was First Sea Lord for a short time, because he only held the post for a very short time, and then Michael Leffenhew went sick, and he moved up to Chief of the Defence Staff. To lesser mortals lower down in the scene, it was not apparent that this was an effective arrangement. And it was very distressing. I'll come back to that later on, because at the end of my time in another job, when I was assistant chief, I determined to do something about it once I got out, and did. And I had no problem in the outfield. And I'm sorry to say, to pick on another service, as opposed to just generalize between the other two services, but the rivalry was most intense, I think is a fair description, as between two shades of blue, as between the Navy and the Royal Air Force. And that was just a fact of life. And I hate to say it, but there is, shall I say, a higher degree of edginess between those two, even today. Now, I can speculate reasons for that, but I don't know that it's particularly wise. And I think it goes back to the war years. And at the start of, I'm talking World War II, there were a number of rating pilots in the Air Force, other rank pilots. And the development of both bombers and fighters was extreme, of course, in the early part of the war. And I think that increasingly the aircraft became more capable, became bombers in particular became bigger, and so on. Responsibility became greater. And very justifiably and sensibly, the Air Force Board of the day demanded a higher rate of pay for those in those positions of higher responsibility, namely other rank pilots. And this was rejected. One of the most unwise things that any government has ever done, I think. But it was rejected. And I think with complete justification, the Air Force Board said, right, if that's the way you want it, you can have it. We will make them officers, and then you'll have to pay them more. And a good cross-section of people who, I'll go no further than to say, might not in the ordinary course of events have ever become officers, became so overnight. And I don't think you can blame the Air Force Board of the day for that. They were driven into it. But they have suffered from it to an extent ever since. And they had something, whether you call it a chip on the shoulder, but they had a slightly different outlook and a slightly different approach to matters, and they were at times inclined to be a little oversensitive, perhaps. I'm picking my words carefully because I don't want to, I have many Air Force friends and I have the greatest admiration for them. But they are perhaps more capable, more often, of being more difficult in relationship terms than relationships between, say, sailors and soldiers. I'll leave it at that. It's probably said too much.
Thank you. I did ask the specific question about some examples of the difficulties that you faced, therefore, probably with the Air Force, specifically whilst you were at Director of Naval Plans, if you were able to comment on that. Whilst you were Director of Naval Plans, I was just going to ask whether you could give an example of a specific difficulty which you experienced of the infighting, if you're able.
Well, one classic example was the case of the old Ark Royal. Now, the decision had already been taken by, I think it was Dennis Healy, to phase out the fixed-wing carriers in the Navy. Not a very wise decision, but it was all part of a progression